from Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. president pays respects in Saudi Arabia. Reaction to the Houthi rebel action in Yemen.
The Houthis, I think, will find it very difficult because it appears Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are not willing to help them.
Talks are being held in Russia on the Syrian conflict and a snow fizzle for parts of the northeastern United States. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. President Obama has cut short a three-day official visit to India to head a 30-member bipartisan U.S. delegation to Saudi Arabia to meet new Saudi king Salman bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud following the death last week of his half-brother and predecessor, King Abdullah. Mr. Obama's visit comes amid turmoil in neighboring Yemen, concerns over Iran's nuclear program. Amin Sakhail, director of Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, the U.S. attaches great importance to what he calls this de facto alliance, America's top oil exporter and coalition partner against the Islamic State group in Iraq and Syria.
One must not forget that he has been the crown prince of Saudi Arabia for many years, and particularly over the last 2 years when King Abdullah was in a very fragile state, Crown Prince Salman would have been involved in all the important domestic and foreign policy decisions made in the kingdom. And I think he owes it very much to his predecessor to follow his policies. And therefore, I think he would be just as keen in maintaining Saudi Arabia's close relationship with the United States as President Obama and many members of his delegation would be.
There is a lot of turmoil in the region, particularly Sunni-Shia turmoil. Is this struggle reaching a turning point, a crisis point?
Well, it is in many ways. I mean, it is becoming more and more a struggle between jihadis and counter-jihadis. But there are now reports that Kurdish segments of the Iraqi population, and more specifically its Peshmerga militia, is recruiting Westerners to come and fight for it. And we know that some organizations have been set up in Britain and, of course, in the United States recruiting fighters for the Kurds. And I think that is a very dangerous development because it has serious implications not only for the situation in the region, but also for the relationship between the West and the world of Islam.
As you know, the president's short trip to Saudi Arabia comes as negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program enter a delicate stage. Saudi Arabia has to be very concerned about the direction Iran's nuclear program is going.
Well, the Saudis have been expressing concerns over a long period of time, and I think this time President Obama will have an opportunity to reassure the new king of Saudi Arabia that the United States will not reach an agreement with Iran which could possibly be harmful to Saudi Arabia or harmful to Saudi interests in the region. Just in the same way that President Obama has been trying to reassure the Israelis who have expressed very deep opposition to any form of agreement between the United States and Iran. And we also know at the same time that the Iranians are very keen to reach some sort of agreement over the nuclear issue because it will benefit Iran enormously, particularly at the time when President Rouhani wants to engage in serious domestic and foreign policy reforms. But in the same way, a reconciliation between the United States and Iran could also help President Obama in dealing with some of the major problems in the region, not only in terms of countering the IS, but also trying to find a resolution of the problems in Syria, as well as in relation to Bahrain and possibly even the Arab-Israeli conflict, also in relation to Yemen.
Amin Sakhail, Director of Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. The U.S. State Department has expressed concern over the resignation of Yemeni President Abd Rabu Mansour Hadi and his cabinet, calling on all sides to avoid violence. Houthi militiamen overran the presidential palace last week following a four-month armed conflict in the capital. The self-styled revolutionary group is seeking an expanded political role, triggering what the president called total deadlock in government. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy asked former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, David Newton, his response to the developments.
I think it was clear to everyone, the president and the parliament, that they were completely powerless, so they saw no point in continuing and decided to give up, and perhaps they're trying to see how the Houthis can run things.
But what the developments in Yemen could eventually lead to a civil war, power struggle, power vacuum, what do you make of that?
It's threatening to lead to chaos. It's a very serious situation. Yemen is severely overpopulated now. It's unable to support itself. It's unable to feed itself. It's dependent on aid from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, who seem not to be willing to help right now, as long as the Houthis are in charge. The situation looks very dire. For a long time, Yemen survived with a very weak government because the society was stable. But now society and politics have become very unstable. So the situation, we're threatened with chaos. Perhaps fairly widespread starvation, and perhaps even a great deal of violence.
Would Houthis' reliance on force encourage angry Sunni tribes to make alliances with al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula?
Well, there are some alliances already with some tribes. Saudi Arabia's influence has brought a lot of Sunni fundamentalism in the country, and this has led the Houthis to believe that their future was in doubt, completely in doubt, and they have struck back. And some of their demands are indeed reasonable. After all, half the country are Zaydi Shia, and they certainly have not been given any attention or share of power. But no government really is in the position to meet the demands because it has no money and no ability to enforce its rule.
So are Houthi rebels waging a proxy war on behalf of Iran against eastern tribes that are supported by Saudi Arabia?
No, I don't believe this. There certainly are maybe even increasing contacts with Iran, but the Shia of Yemen, the Zaydis, are not of the same kind of persuasion as the Twelver Shias in Iran. And this is a homegrown movement. This is the origin of the Yemeni state, the Zaydis in the north. Now, whatever ties they have, and they are certainly anti-Al-Qaeda, have been fighting Al-Qaeda, and they are very much concerned about the growth of Sunni fundamentalist influence in the country, which to a significant degree has been introduced via Saudi Arabia.
Would the departure of King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia impact the Saudi policy in Yemen?
It certainly could. You know, the problem, of course, that has faced Saudi Arabia in recent years is that the government is sclerotic, not only politically but physically. They're composed of people in their 80s and 90s. It's not really doing a great job of keeping up with the rapid crises. And now with the loss of King Abdullah, who was finding it difficult to get his policies implemented anyway, and with a new king in doubtful health, and with a succession crisis looming in the fairly near future, as the country finally runs out of princes who are brothers and who have one after the other ascended to the throne, there's a new game looming in Saudi Arabia, which may direct much of Saudi Arabia's intentions internally.
What would the developments in Yemen mean for U.S. with regard to relying on the Yemeni government as a major partner in combating al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula?
Well, if there isn't any Yemeni government, there isn't much to rely on. The Houthis, I think, will find it very difficult because it appears Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are not willing to help them as long as they are in control of the government. They seem to have sort of unable to restrain their people and backed into taking control when they said they didn't want direct control. But now they're going to have to deliver, and they have no resources to do so. And if Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states wait until the country collapses because they don't want to help a Shia regime, then we could have indeed a very serious situation. One would hope the Houthis would continue to fight al-Qaeda. That certainly would be a plus. But the whole situation in Yemen is deteriorating so much and is getting so much out of control that it will be very difficult for the U.S. and the great efforts that the U.N. are making to try to keep some momentum going towards reform in the country.
Any policy recommendation for the U.S. at this moment?
I think the U.S. should try to encourage the Gulf states not to drive Yemen down to absolute chaos because of their Saudi dislike of the Zaydis. They are, after all, really real Yemenis. Yemen will be a client state financially of the Gulf for the foreseeable future. And the other issue that they need to be careful of, there will be increasing pressure for the South to split away with the Zaydis in charge. And I think we need some diplomacy to try to keep that country together.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Yemen, David Newton. Preliminary talks are being held in Moscow among Syrian opposition groups on a Russian initiative to revive Syrian peace talks. Representatives of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad are scheduled to join the four-day meeting Wednesday, but the main Western-backed opposition alliance, the National Coalition for Syrian Revolutionary and Opposition Force, is boycotting the talks. The United States is publicly committed to removing Assad, but has not objected to the conference. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has said he hopes the gathering can prove useful. As the talks began Monday, Deputy Foreign Minister Mikhail Bogdanov told reporters that if the atmosphere is constructive, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov would meet with both government and opposition delegations Wednesday. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy discussed possible approaches to find a political solution to the Syrian crisis with James Zogby, president of the Washington-based Arab American Institute.
Dr. Zogby, after four bloody years in Syria, what can be done to reach a political solution?
I think more pressure from the United States and Russia. When we say that we've tried and we can't, I can't accept the fact that a superpower does not have the diplomatic strength to say to our allies in Saudi Arabia and to say to the Iranians that the plug has to be pulled, that we have to stop funding the competing groups, and that this proxy war is one that no one will win in the end. There needs to be a political formula that will only come if the Saudis and Iranians agree to it. But for that to happen, the United States and Russia have to oversee, using their political strength, a diplomatic process.
What role can the U.S. play when Russia is taking the initiative now with the Moscow initiative?
Well, I think Secretary Kerry's statement that that the talks were a good idea, more encouragement. I think beyond just saying that, we have to say to our allies and those we work with and support that they should be there. There's no loss in talking. There's no loss in participating in this. We've got to be serious about supporting this effort, just as we would expect the Russians to support a broader political effort to achieve a negotiated solution.
Egyptian President Sisi is trying to unite the Syrian opposition. Would that be a good step toward facilitating a political solution?
Absolutely. I think that while I have disagreements with President Sisi on his domestic policies, I think he has played his Syrian policy well. He's kept the door open to all sides, and he has, I think, the regional weight to do what Turkey could not do, which is to convene all the parties, and I think his effort should be supported as well.
Should the U.S. and Syrian opposition change their position, which insists that Assad must go?
Well, we heard from former Ambassador Ford that the opposition was willing to negotiate with Assad as part of a negotiating process. I don't believe that in the end of the day they will accept Assad remaining as he is, a dictatorial head of the entire regime, but as a transitional process, there's no way you begin the transitional process by making your demand at the beginning that it be implemented. In other words, that he has to be gone from the beginning of talks. I think that what Ford said was that the opposition was agreeing to that, and that's a very good step. Now the burden is on Assad to follow through and support support a negotiated process. That's where the Iranians are important. Look, if we're using all the leverage we have with the Iranians on the nuclear question, I think that's somewhat misplaced. The far more critical issue right now is Iran's regional role, not only in Syria, but also in Iraq and in Yemen and elsewhere. We've got to put all those issues on the table with them.
What kind of challenge does the expansion of the so-called Islamic State present to a potential political solution to the Syrian crisis?
At the end of the day, all of the political parties and forces in Syria have got to confront the Islamic State together. This is not a battle that will be won by Assad. It's not a battle that will be won by the moderate opposition. It's got to be won by a new Syrian government. It will not be solved until we achieve a political formula that changes the structure in Syria for the future.
James Zoghbi, president of the Washington-based Arab American Institute.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The northeastern United States has been bracing for what weather forecasters dubbed a historic winter storm, but it just didn't turn out to be as bad as expected in some areas. When I drove to work in the wee hours of the morning today, the light snow was still falling, but the streets were clear. Just had to brush off the car, and my snow boots were really hardly needed at all. And New York City was supposed to get plastered, but our correspondent up there, Adam Phillips, tells me despite all the concern, they really are doing well. What can you tell me about what's going on, Adam?
Well, it was kind of a bust, although it was fun getting ready for the whole thing. I mean, last night, the supermarket had huge lines. People were very, very worried. They scurried home. Kids were happy, of course. The mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, called for a traffic ban, so there were hardly any cars on the road at all, including New Yorkers' beloved delivery vehicles couldn't come and deliver food to people and have their Chinese food in their, you know, cozy quilts. But other than that, it was just a lot of snow, but it didn't really amount to anything that would inconvenience anybody or endanger anybody. And so it was kind of a bust from that point of view. So people felt relieved, but you'd be a little disappointed because New Yorkers like a bit of drama as well.
Well, what about a little bit further up north from you, though? It was a little bit more difficult up there.
It did get worse in New England, which is northeast of New York City. They're used to a lot of snow over there, and you know, they're very, very hardy about it. They take great pride in preparing, but they also didn't get it as bad as they thought they did. About a third of a meter in Cape Cod. Nantucket got it the worst. And they were a little bit worried about high tides because the big wind, and there are hurricane-force winds there, may create some flooding and destroy homes. So they're sort of battening down the hatches in that region.
Well, you folks in New York are known to be pretty hardy, too. I guess today's going to be a big play day.
Yeah, it's going to be a big play day. Kids are going to love it. My own child is going to make snowman and go outside, and there's lots of cocoa at the end, And, of course, they don't have to go to school. The kids are a little bit older, and they're very happy about that, although the bad news is they'll have to make it up sometime later. New Yorkers have a very interesting relationship with snow. They sort of take it personally, that how could nature have the effrontery of sort of inconveniencing them at all? We have such an artificial environment here that we love that it's sort of interesting to see nature sort of shake her skirts when something like this happens.
Do you think that people are going to complain that everybody was over-prepared for this storm?
No, I mean, Superstorm Sandy is still in people's minds. So I think that people generally, or at least it seems to me, the sensible view is to be more prepared rather than less prepared. I mean, it's true that the weather predictors really pretty much had it kind of wrong. And I'm sure that there'll be cries of alarmism, you know, from the mayor and Governor Cuomo and people like that. But I think that people will take it in stride and be glad that at least they could have been safe if they were endangered.
Thanks a lot, Adam.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 27, 1756, one of the world's most brilliant composers, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, was born in Salzburg, Austria. By the time of his death at the age of 35, Mozart had completed more than 40 symphonies, nearly 30 piano concertos, as well as dozens of piano sonatas and operas. In 1901, Italian romantic composer Giuseppe Verdi died following a stroke. Verdi was one of the most influential composers of Italian opera. His works included Rigoletto and La Traviata. On this day in 1888, the National Geographic Society came into being in Washington, D.C. to further the understanding of geography. Over the years, the Society has sponsored expeditions and research projects that have furthered human understanding of the natural world. Its official journal, the National Geographic Magazine, is still published. In 1944, the Soviet Army finally broke the nearly 900-day siege of Leningrad by German forces. Refusing to surrender, the citizens of what is today St. Petersburg suffered bombardment, starvation, and disease, costing hundreds of thousands of lives. 1 year later, Soviet forces liberated remaining inmates at the infamous Auschwitz death camp in Poland. Over 1 million people were killed at the German camp. In 1967, the three-man crew of Apollo 1 died inside the capsule while training for the first mission designed to send men to the moon. Command pilot Virgil Grissom, senior pilot Ed White, and pilot Robert Chafee were unable to exit a hatch when faulty wiring caught fire. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Some 50 million people are currently displaced, having left their homes to escape violence, according to the UNHCR, the United Nations agency that deals with refugees and internally displaced people across the globe. This is the greatest number of people that have been forced to leave their homes to escape violence since the Second World War. As new conflicts emerge and old ones reignite, while smaller threats to civilian populations grow to become remarkably dangerous, so more and more civilians are uprooted. This certainly holds true for last year, as ISIL stepped up its drive to impose a reign of terror over parts of Syria and Iraq. Civil conflicts reignited in South Sudan, and violence continued to impact civilians in the Central African Republic. These are disputes that seem to defy traditional diplomacy and international consensus, and all too often the violence is indiscriminate, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, Ann C. Richard. Working with partners such as the UNHCR, the World Food Program, UNICEF, and numerous other aid agencies, NGOs, and with other governments, the United States has worked hard to mobilize an effective response. Last year, the United States provided more than $6 billion in humanitarian assistance around the world, more than any other single donor. Our goal is to help people thrive instead of just surviving. So we work with our partners to alleviate the plight of refugees, many of whom have been in exile for 2 decades or more, by offering technical and vocational training, apprenticeships, and micro-enterprise development programs. We support not just the refugees themselves, but also help countries that have taken in citizens of strife-torn neighboring nations, funding clinics, schools, and essential infrastructure in areas that host these refugees. And as the world's leader in refugee resettlement, thousands of refugees will get a new start at life here in the United States. Around the world, we use diplomacy and financial support to focus attention on those caught up in conflict, to protect and care for them and uphold their human rights, said Assistant Secretary Richard, and we are constantly looking for ways to do this better.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.